without them. I never caved to the impulse, of course. It's repulsively selfish, and I've chewed my cheek bloody just admitting it here. Other people's grief is not about you. Letting self-consciousness supersede empathy is barbaric. I'm the first to drop off a casserole, send flowers and a card. Anything I can do. Thinking of you so much right now. But before death had ever touched me directly, those interactions felt like trying to dance, sober, in a brightly lit room. Someone picked me up at the airport and drove me to my parents' house, where my dad either was or wasn't, I can't remember. He was in and out of the hospital so often at that time, it was hard to keep track. Elation swapping places with despair at flickering speeds, like a zoetrope animating the last days of my childhood. Flick, flick, flick. Even though my mother was a nurse and I grew up immersed in hospital culture, talking eyeball surgery over dinner, specimen cups full of mandarin oranges in my school lunch, I didn't understand shit about hospitals. I didn't know that even the best ones were miserable and lonely places, where you couldn't sleep more than a couple hours at a stretch, where, with each second you weren't discharged, you could see the outline of your death shiver into focus. Hospitals were full of medicines, and machines, and doctors, and hyper-competent people like my mother. I thought they were a place you went to get better, not a place you went to die. Cancer doesn't hand you an itinerary. It's not like, up to a certain point, you have an okay amount of cancer, and then one day the doctor's like, uh-oh, too much cancer, and then all your loved ones rush to your bedside for some stoic, wise goodbyes. Cancer, at least in my dad's case, is a complex breaking down of multiple systems, both slow and sudden. You have 6 months, and then you have 6 hours. Treatments are messy, painful, and often humiliating. The cost-benefit is anything but clear. My dad didn't want to die. He turned 76 that year, but until his prostate fucked everything up, he radiated the same tireless exuberance as he always had. My mom said he didn't like hearing his own prognoses, so she met with the doctors herself, carried the future inside her all alone. She the realist and he the fantasist as ever. In those final weeks, though, even Dad couldn't deny that his body was failing. That horrible Thanksgiving, when he vomited into the empty margarine tub at the dinner table, was when I first noticed it. He had begun grieving, for himself, for the life he wasn't ready to leave behind. I, true to form, was terrified of his grief. Those days eat at me. Why didn't I spend more time sitting with him? Why did I sleep so much? Why didn't I read out loud to him our favorite books, the ones he read to me when I was little? Why was I so fucking chirpy in all of our interactions, desperate to gloss over the truth instead of letting myself be vulnerable with him? Why the fuck did I move to LA 3 months before he died? What was wrong with me? Who does that? He wanted me to go, though. That was before he admitted he was dying. If I had stayed, it would have been confirmation that something was really wrong. And there was nothing he loved more than watching his children stride out into the world and flourish. "Knock 'em dead, kid," he said. And I did. It's so fucking unfair that he didn't get to see it. Eventually, I ran out of chances to sit with him, to be vulnerable, to tell the truth. We went to the hospital for the last time. As Dad drifted in and out of consciousness, my sister and I read to him from the book he was halfway through at the time, A Jazz Odyssey, The Life of Oscar Peterson. Aham once told me that Oscar Peterson, my dad's hero, was the lovable dork of the jazz pantheon. "He's incredibly well-respected," Aham hedged. "He's amazing, just the least edgy player ever. He's kind of like Superman." Peterson never had a drug problem, he loved his wives, he was huge in Canada. Unsurprisingly then, where my sister and I picked up in A Jazz Odyssey, Peterson was describing a hobby that I can confidently declare the exact opposite of being a philandering New York needle junkie, pottering around America's parks and monuments with his wife Kelly in their brand new Winnebago. My dad roused every once in a while and chuckled as Peterson detailed with reverence the Winnebago's gleaming chrome accents and spacious over-cab loft bed. The open road, the Great Plains, Kelly by his side, this was the life. Until it came time to empty the Winnebago's sewage tank. Oscar was pretty sure he could figure it out unassisted. I looked up from the book into my sister's expectant face and over at my dad's unconscious one. Was Oscar Peterson about to tell us a story about gallons and gallons of his and his wife's liquefied feces spraying out of a Winnebago? Was I about to read it out loud in a soothing voice at my father's deathbed? Yes. Yes, I was. Dad's hospital room was small. Only two guests could hang out in there comfortably, so my mom, my sister, and I took turns sleeping in the chair next to his bed, holding his hand, while one of us lounged on the cushioned bench under the window, and the odd woman out decamped to the cafeteria, or the family lounge down the hall. The family lounge was a small, windowless room with an old TV, a couch upholstered in what looked like leftover airport carpet, and a pile of battered, cast-off VHS tapes, because nothing takes the edge off your father's slow suffocation like Speed 2 Cruise Control. Did you know that sometimes there just isn't anything else that doctors can do to save your dad? I knew it intellectually before this experience, but I didn't understand it in practice. In practice, it means that at a certain point, a fallible human being called a doctor has to make a subjective decision that it is no longer feasible to mitigate both the internal bleeding and concomitant dehydration of your father, so all you can do is give him enough morphine that it doesn't hurt so much when he drowns inside of his own body. And you have to go, okay, and then let them do that, and then wait. My dad lost consciousness on Saturday night. My mom told me to go home and sleep, that she'd call me if it looked like he was going to go. I passed out on my parents' couch, making peace with the fact that I would probably miss the end. It was okay. I had said goodbye, told him I loved him. But the next morning, when I woke up, he was still holding on. He was always strong. He didn't want to go. So back I went. We picked up our routine again, chair, bench, family lounge, and we sat there, waiting, all day Sunday, into Monday. Each breath got slower and rougher. I use a French press now because I can't bear the percolator. And we sat and listened to every one. Sometimes a team of doctors would come in and loom over us with well-rehearsed but clinical concern. "How are you doing?" they would ask. "Oh, you mean besides sitting here on this plastic hospital chair listening to the world's best dude struggle for breath for the past 36 hours? Fucking gangbusters, I guess. Is there anything we can do?" "Apparently not, considering this whole long, slow death thing that's happening in this room right now. Also, you're the doctor. You tell me." I have never wanted anything as much as I wanted that shitty purgatory to be over. Except for one thing, which was for that shitty purgatory to never be over. Because when it's over, it's over. And eventually it was. Monday afternoon, my dad stopped breathing, faded to black and white like an old movie, and I don't know how else to describe it, flattened slightly, as though whatever force was keeping him in three dimensions had abruptly packed up and moved on. He was, and then he wasn't. One moment his body was the locus of his personhood, the next moment our memories had to pick up the slack. A nurse brought us granola bars and juice boxes on a little rolling cart, like a "your dad died" door prize. A guy with a mop came in to start cleaning up the room for the next patient. There was someone with a clipboard asking questions. "Could you give us a fucking minute?" my mom snapped. "My husband just died 30 seconds ago." We sat with the body that used to be him. I didn't understand the point, honestly. Back in November, before Thanksgiving, before the tree fell on the house, before the hospital, Aham and I met up at a bar on Capitol Hill. We hadn't spoken in a week or so, and my pain and anger had cooled to something more permeable. I'd spent that time with friends and family, eating and drinking and carrying on, coming back to myself, getting reacquainted with the person I'd been before Aham, even before Mike. I had an identity other than my relationship. I remembered it now. And this grimy fish tank I built around us hadn't been good for me either. Grudgingly, I'd come to see Aham's point a little bit. He fell in love with this person, and in my desperation to hang on to him, I morphed myself into something else entirely. He wanted a partner, but I gave him a parasitic twin. Except worse than that. A parasitic twin that cried all the time. Worst X-Files episode ever. At the bar, Aham and I ate tater tots and got drunk. We didn't talk about our relationship, and I didn't cry. I felt detached. My capacity for sadness was maxed out. I'd given up on trying to force him to come back to me, and he apologized for trying to force me to be his friend. Somehow, we had fun. Relief poured back and forth between us, quietly electric. Aham had a gleam I hadn't seen in months. For a minute, we held hands, and something woke, tiny but palpable, in my chest. Outside, it snowed. Big, fat, wet flakes. I dropped him at the bus stop and said I'd see him in L.A., feeling something that wasn't quite despair for the first time in a month. He said we'd talk. Of course, that never happened. He flew back down the day after the tree fell, and I was already gone. I took my bereavement juice box to the family lounge and called Aham in L.A. "Can you just come?" I sobbed. "Of course," he said. We weren't back together, but we weren't not together. We weren't sleeping together, but he slept in the bed with me and held on to me as much as I needed. He ran errands for my mom, made her laugh, cooked Eggs Benedict, booked a piano player for the funeral, figured out how to get a banquet license while I cried in the liquor store. My aunt and uncle came up from Arizona and stayed with us. Aham's girls would come on the weekends. Friends and family dropped by nearly every day. We sat around and drank beer and watched football, all piled together in that little white house. It was a beautiful chaos, the same kind my mom grew up in and loved so much, the kind that I never understood growing up alone. It's weird to look back at the saddest month of my life and see that little vein of joy. Aham and I weren't getting back together. We swore we weren't. We couldn't. But when I wasn't looking, he had become my family anyway. The beginning. We went back to L.A. and lived in limbo for a few months. Aham went on tour. I started working at Jezebel. We weren't together, but we were happy in a totally unfamiliar way. I'm not saying that if your relationship is in trouble, you should cross your fingers that your dad dies. Footnote. Unless you hate your dad, I guess, in which case you can cross your fingers for whatever you want. As long as you are not crossing them around the trigger of a dad-murdering gun. Look, don't murder your dad. It will not make your boyfriend get back together with you. I don't know how much more clearly I can say this. But after my dad's funeral, I was older. Aham wasn't the only thing in my world anymore. My pain, and later my career, had pushed him aside a little bit, and that space was exactly what he needed. I'm a narcissist, he jokes, but I didn't actually want to date my own reflection. Aham had come through for me in that month of emotional triage with a selflessness that I think surprised us both, not out of some sense of obligation, but because he really wanted to be there, in my mom's basement, mixing gin and tonics for my Auntie Austrie. It was a horrendous period, but somehow we had fun. We worked so hard to make each other laugh. We were just ourselves again. It was like a reset. When Aham got back from tour, we sat down for a 2-day feelings marathon. Even for me, a professional leaking sad bag, it was a nightmare. There were scheduled breaks. We punched in and out like trudging coal miners. We wrote up a contract specifying how much crying was allowed. My opening offer was 100% of the time. Aham lowballed with a blank stare. The details are boring and some of them are just mine, but at the end of it, we were a couple again. I don't even think of it as getting back together because it didn't feel like a reconvening of the old relationship. It was a new one. If we're going to do this, he told me, giving me his most intense face, we're really doing it. Don't change your mind on me. It's hard to talk about because the realist in me, i.e. my mom, kind of doesn't believe that couples getting back together is a real thing. It's something I believed in when I was a child, when I understood a relationship as something that happened to you, not something you built. And I thought The Parent Trap was the ultimate love story. But we really did do it, and the only explanation I can offer is that we weren't the same people in Relationship Part 2 as we were in Relationship The Phantom Menace. Aham still wasn't sure that he believed in marriage anymore. It was understandable. He'd been divorced twice in the previous 6 years. I used up some of my tear allotment on that, not because I have any particular attachment to the institution of marriage, but because I just wanted to prove to the world that I was worth marrying. I grew up assuming that I would never get married, because marriage was for thin women, the kind of women who deserved to be collected. How could I be a bride when I was already what men most feared their wives would become? I was the mise en place for a midlife crisis. I was the ghost of adultery future. At least, that's what I'd been taught. Aham was my shot at vindication. Come on, man. Think of all the fat girls we can inspire with our lifelong legal commitment. Okay, what if we still like each other this much in 5 years? I bargained, annoyingly persistent, but in a charming way, I'm sure. Can we talk about getting married then? In 5 years, if we still like each other exactly this much, sure, we can talk about getting married, Aham said, rolling his eyes. You are the most annoying person on earth. That was good enough for me. It was basically a proposal. We moved back to Seattle a few weeks after that. We rented a house and settled into a routine, our pre-breakup life already distant and foreign, like it happened to someone else. Every day I take his face in my hands and squeeze, because I think he might be a mirage. He declares crab fingers, his second favorite game, and pinches me until I fall out of bed. I call him and say gross stuff like, I want to hug you and kiss you, and he goes, who is this, Jacynthia? And pretends to have a secret family. We show our love in different ways. But being in love holds its own kind of challenges. Once, Aham and I were sitting at a bar holding hands, and a woman recognized me. She was a fan of my writing, so she came up to introduce herself, and we shambled through a few minutes of pleasant chit-chat. Sensing the conversation was running out of steam, she asked me one of the questions that people always ask me in those awkward, floundering moments. So, what's it like to work from home? Aren't you lonely? Not really, I said. I gestured to Aham. He works from home, too. It's hard to feel alone when there's a guy constantly playing the trumpet in your face. She laughed and turned to him. So, you two are roommates? Yes, lady. We are platonic adult roommates who hold hands at bars. This is clearly the only logical explanation. Actually, since you asked, I recently sustained a pulsing gash to the palm, and he's just holding the wound closed until paramedics arrive. Also, every night before bed, a rattlesnake bites me on the mouth, and he has to suck out the poison. It's the weirdest thing. We should probably move. I wasn't surprised that this woman took so many willful leaps past couple and landed on roommates in her split-second sussing out of our relationship. It happens all the time. But it was a disheartening reminder of an assumption that has circumscribed my life. Couples ought to match. Aham and I do not. I am fat, and he is not. He is conventionally desirable, and I am a before picture in an ad for liquefied bee eggs that you spray on your food to tell cravings to buzz off. Copyrighted, send me all the money. It is considered highly unlikely, borderline inconceivable, that he would choose to be with me in a culture where men are urged to perpetually upgrade to the hottest woman within reach, not only for their own supposed gratification, but also to impress and compete with other men. It is women's job to be decorative, within a very narrow set of parameters, and it is men's job to collect them. My relationship throws off both sides of that equation, and a lot of people find it bewildering at best, enraging at worst. There are long, manic message board threads devoted to comparing photos of me with photos of Aham's thin, conventionally pretty second ex-wife. Number one is blessedly absent from the old MySpace page he doesn't know how to take down. Number two is not so lucky. And dissecting what personality disorder could possibly have caused him to downgrade so egregiously. Servers always assume we want separate checks. Women hit on him right in front of me, and the late-night Facebook messages are a constant, as though they could just have him, and he would say, oh, thank God you finally showed up, and leave me, and some dire cosmic imbalance would be corrected. It's nothing personal, it's just that they match. They can talk about hot people problems together, like too many clothing options and haters. I wouldn't understand. It's not that I'm not attracted to fat men. I have dated men of all sizes. But the assumption that fat people should only be with fat people is dehumanizing. It assumes that we are nothing but bodies. Well, sorry. I am a human, and I would like to be with the human I like the best. He happens to not be fat, but if he were, I would love him just the same. Isn't that the whole point, to be more than just bodies? When I think back on my teenage self, what I really needed to hear wasn't that someone might love me one day if I lost enough weight to qualify as human. It was that I was worthy of love now, just as I was. Being fat and happy and in love is still a radical act. That's why a wedding mattered to me. Not because of a dress, or a diamond, or a cake, or a blender. Okay, maybe a cake. Footnote. We had like six. Aham took me out for dinner on my 32nd birthday, then suggested a quick nightcap at our neighborhood bar. Everyone was there. It was a surprise. Our friends, our families, the kids, a cake. I was so happy. Aham took my hand and led me to the back. There was a paper banner that said my name. The bartender made it. We go there a lot. Our friends Evan and Sam were playing a duet on cello and bass. I was confused. Why were there somber strings at my birthday party? Why was Aham doing intense face? Wait, it's almost 10 p.m. on a school night and we're at a bar. Why are the kids here? Then it all happened at once. The knee, the ring, the speech, the question, the tears. All the hits. It was a full-blown grand gesture. He tricked me. He said 5 years. I was ready to wait 5 years. He only lasted 2. Later, I asked him why he did it that way. Such a big spectacle, such an event. Not precisely our style. And I expected something cliché but sweet, like, I wanted to make sure our community was a part of our marriage. Or, I wanted everyone to know how much I love you. Instead, he said, one time when you were drunk, you told me, if you ever propose to me, don't do it in the bullshit way that dudes usually treat fat girls, like it's a secret, or you're just trying to keep me from leaving you. Thin girls get public proposals like those dudes are winning a fucking prize. Fat chicks deserve that too. It's not that I'd ever particularly yearned for a grand gesture. The relationship I cherish lives in our tiny private moments. But the older I get and the longer I live in a fat body, the harder it is to depoliticize even simple acts. A public proposal to a publicly valued body might be personally significant, but culturally it shifts nothing. A public proposal to a publicly reviled body is a political statement. As soon as you start making wedding plans, you're bombarded with, among a million other beckoning money pits, a barrage of pre-wedding weight loss programs. Because you're supposed to be as thin as possible on your special day. After all, there will be pictures. And what if someone remembers your butt as looking like what your butt looks like? I'm only eating grapefruit and steam until my wedding. I enrolled my whole wedding party in bridal boot camp. I bought my dress in a size 4, even though I'm a size 6. And that's totally fine, of course, if that's your priority. It wasn't mine. I don't hide anymore in my everyday life, and I definitely wasn't going to hide at my wedding. We got married a year and a half after the proposal, in July, at my parents' cabin a few hours outside of Seattle. Even though I believe that death is a hard return, I can always feel my dad at the cabin. It was his favorite place. I walked down the aisle to a recording of him playing Someone to Watch Over Me on the piano. Aham wore a blue plaid suit. A bald eagle flapped over the ceremony. Someone spilled red wine on one of the beds, and my mom was in a good enough mood to forgive them. I got my fucking period. Will you never leave me be, fell ghoul? It poured down rain after a month of uninterrupted sunshine, then abruptly stopped just as we emerged from the tent to dance. Megan brought the house down with a toast about how Great Aunt Eleanor died believing Megan and I were lesbian lovers. A friend of mine, post-late-night hot tubbing, got confused about the route to the bathroom and walked into my mom's bedroom naked. Oh, and Aham's 100-year-old great-grandmother had a stroke on the way to the wedding, went to the hospital, got better, and still came and partied. It was a gorgeous, chaotic, loving, perfect day. We scribbled our vows 5 minutes before the ceremony. Aham's read, "You know that thing that I do that you hate? That thing where I talk about how years ago when we were friends, and I always wanted to hang out with you, and I would always text you, and I would see you and be like, we should hang out, and then you'd always cancel on me? I am never going to stop bringing that thing up, because I like being right. And all those times that I tried so hard to get you to hang out with me, and I just wanted to be around you so much, I've never been more right about anything in my life. The only way I can think to say it is that you are better than I thought people could be. I am happier than I thought people could be." Slaying the Troll. One ordinary midsummer afternoon in 2013, I got a message from my dead dad. I don't remember what it said exactly, and I didn't keep a copy for my scrapbook, but it was mean. My dad was never mean. It couldn't really be from him. Also, he was dead. Just 18 months earlier, I'd watched him turn gray and drown in his own magnificent lungs, so I was like 80% sure. And I don't believe in heaven, and even if I did, I'd hope to non-existent God they don't have fucking Twitter there. It's heaven! Go play chocolate badminton on a cloud with Jerry Orbach and your childhood cat. But there it was, this message. It was well into the rape joke summer, and my armor was thick. I was eating 30 rape threats for breakfast at that point, or, more accurately, you're fatter than the girls I usually rape threats, and I felt fortified and righteous. No one could touch me anymore. There was nothing remarkable about this particular tweet. Oh, some white dude thinks I'm ugly, fat, stupid, humorless, boring. Does the Pope fart in Latin? And by all conceivable logic, it shouldn't have even registered. It certainly shouldn't have hurt. The account was called Paw West Dunzo. Paw West because his name was Paul West, and Dunzo because he was done being alive. Done making up funny songs. Done doing crossword puzzles. Done not being able to get the printer to work. Done getting annoyingly obsessed with certain kinds of popsicles. Done being so strong. Done being my dad. Embarrassed father of an idiot, the bio read. Other two kids are fine, though. His location, dirt hole in Seattle. The profile photo was a familiar picture of him. He's sitting at his piano, smiling, in the living room of the house where I grew up. Some of the keys on that piano still have gray smudges worked into the grain, the ghost of old graphite where he'd penciled in the names of the notes for me when I was small. I never practiced enough. He always pretended not to be disappointed. The day they sold that house, when I was 25, I sat on the stairs and sobbed harder than I ever had. Because a place is kind of like a person, you know? It felt like a death, I thought. My family was broken, I thought. I wouldn't cry that hard again until December 12th, 2011, when I learned that a place is not like a person at all. Only a person is a person. Only a death is really a death. Watching someone die in real life isn't like in the movies, because you can't make a movie that's 4 days long where the entire plot is just three women crying and eating candy while a brusque nurse absentmindedly adjusts a catheter bag and tries to comfort them with cups of room temperature water. Saturday afternoon, when we could feel his lucidity slipping, we called my brother in Boston, my dad's firstborn. "You were such a special little boy," he said. "I love you very much." He didn't say very many things after that. I would give anything for one more sentence. I would give anything for 140 more characters. The person who made the Paw West Dunzo account clearly put some time into it. He researched my father and my family. He found out his name, and then he figured out which Paul West he was among all the thousands of Paul Wests on the internet. He must have read the obituary, which I wrote 2 days after my dad's lungs finally gave out. He knew that Dad died of prostate cancer, and that he was treated at Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. He knew that I have a brother and a sister. And if he knew all that, he must have known how recently we lost him. My armor wasn't strong enough for that. What was my recourse? What could I do? This was before Twitter had a report function, which, as far as I can tell, is just a pretty placebo anyway. And it's not illegal to reach elbow deep into someone's safest, sweetest memories and touch them and twist them and weaponize them to impress the ghost of Lenny Bruce or what the fuck ever. Hell, not only is it not illegal, I'm told it's a victory for free speech and liberty. It's just how the internet works. It's natural. It's inevitable. Grow a thicker skin, piggy. Location, dirt hole in Seattle. All I could do was ignore it, hit block and move on, knowing that that account was still out there, hidden behind a few gossamer lines of code. Paul West Dunzo was still putting words in my dead father's mouth, still touching his memory, still parading his corpse around like a puppet to punish me for something. I didn't even know what. I'm supposed to feel okay just because I can't see it? Yes, you're supposed to feel okay just because you can't see it. There's no other way, we're told. We couldn't possibly change the culture, we're told. There's no winning when it comes to dealing with internet trolls. Conventional wisdom says, don't engage, it's what they want. Is it? Are you sure our silence isn't what they want? Are you sure they care what we do at all? From where I'm sitting, if I respond, I'm a sucker for taking the bait. If I don't respond, I'm a punching bag. I'm the idiot daughter of an embarrassed dead guy. On the record, forever. Faced with a lose-lose like that, what do you do? Ignoring Pa West Dunzo wasn't going to chasten him, or make me feel better, or bring my dad back. So I talked back. I talked back because my mental health, not some troll's personal satisfaction, is my priority. I talked back because it emboldens other women to talk back online and in real life. And I talked back because women have told me that my responses give them a script for dealing with monsters in their own lives. Most importantly, I talked back because internet trolls are not, in fact, monsters. They're human beings who've lost their way, and they just want other people to flounder too. And I don't believe that their attempts to dehumanize me can be counteracted by dehumanizing them. The week after it happened, I wrote about Pa West Dunzo in a Jezebel article about trolling. I wrote sadly, candidly, angrily, with obvious pain. A few hours after the post went up, I got an email. Hey, Lindy. I don't know why or even when I started trolling you. It wasn't because of your stance on rape jokes. I don't find them funny either. I think my anger towards you stems from your happiness with your own being. It offended me because it served to highlight my unhappiness with my own self. I have emailed you through two other Gmail accounts just to send you idiotic insults. I apologize for that. I created the paulwestdunzo@gmail.com account and Twitter account. I have deleted both. I can't say sorry enough. It was the lowest thing I had ever done. When you included it in your latest Jezebel article, it finally hit me. There is a living, breathing human being who is reading this shit. I am attacking someone who has never harmed me in any way, and for no reason whatsoever. I'm done being a troll. Again, I apologize. I made a donation in memory to your dad. I wish you the best. He attached a receipt for a $50 donation to Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, designated Memorial Paul West for Area of Greatest Need. This email still unhinges my jaw every time I read it. A troll apologizing? This had never happened to me before. It has never happened to me since. I do not know anyone to which it has happened, nor have I heard of such a thing in the wide world of internet lore. I've read interviews with scholars who study trolling from an academic perspective, specifically stating that the one thing you never get from a troll is public remorse. I didn't know what to say. I said, "Is this real? If so, thank you. It was really hurtful, but I'm truly sorry for whatever you've been going through that made you feel compelled to do those things. I wish you the best, and thank you for the donation. It means a lot. I love my dad very much." He wrote to me one more time, our final contact. "Yes, it's true. Thank you for responding with more kindness than I deserve. I'm sorry for your loss and any pain I caused you. All the best. Redacted. My real name." I returned to my regular routine of daily hate mail, scrolling through the same options over and over. Ignore, block, report, engage. But every time I faced that choice, I thought briefly of my remorseful troll. I wondered if I could learn anything from him, what he'd tell me to do, if he had really changed. And then it struck me. Oh my God, I still had his email address. I could just ask him. Even if he turned out to be a jerk, it would make a great story. I sent the email. After a few months of torturous waiting, he finally wrote back. "I'd be happy to help you out in any way possible," he said. Within a few days, there I was in a recording studio with a phone and the troll on the other end. We recorded it for This American Life, a popular public radio show. I asked him why he chose me. In his email, he wrote that it wasn't because of the rape joke thing. So what exactly did I do? His voice was soft, tentative. He was clearly as nervous as I was. "Well," he said, "it revolved around one issue that you wrote about a lot, which was your being heavy, the struggles that you had regarding being a woman of size, or whatever the term may be." I cut in. I hate euphemisms. What the fuck is a woman of size, anyway? Who doesn't have a size? You can say fat, that's what I say. Fat, okay, fat. He He told me that at the time he was about 75 pounds heavier than he wanted to be. He hated his body. He was miserable. And reading about fat people, particularly fat women, accepting and loving themselves as they were, infuriated him for reasons he couldn't articulate at the time. When you talked about being proud of who you are, and where you are, and where you're going, he continued, that kind of stoked that anger that I had. Okay, I said, so you found my writing. You found my writing and you did not like it. Certain aspects of it. Yeah. You used a lot of all caps, he said. I laughed, and it got him to laugh a little too. You're just a very... You almost have no fear when you write. You know, it's like you stand on the desk and you say, I'm Lindy West and this is what I believe in. Fuck you if you don't agree with me. And even though you don't say those words exactly, I'm like, who is this bitch who thinks she knows everything? I asked him if he felt that way because I'm a woman. He didn't even hesitate. Oh, definitely, definitely. Women are being more forthright in their writing. There isn't a sense of timidity to when they speak or when they write. They're saying it loud. And I think that, and I think for me as well, it's threatening at first. Right. It was a relief to hear him admit it. So many men cling to the lie that misogyny is a feminist fiction, and rarely do I get such explicit validation that my work is accomplishing exactly what I'm aiming for. You must know that that's why I do that, because people don't expect to hear from women like that. And I want other women to see me do that, and I want women's voices to get louder. I understand, he said. I understand. I really felt like he did. Here's the thing, he went on. I work with women all day, and I don't have an issue with anyone. I could have told you back then if someone had said to me, oh, you're a misogynist, you hate women. And I could say, nuh-uh, I love my mom, I love my sisters, I loved the girlfriends that I've had in my life. But you can't claim to be okay with women and then go online and insult them, seek them out to harm them emotionally. In my experience, if you call a troll a misogynist, he'll almost invariably say, oh, I don't hate women. I just hate what you're saying, and what that other woman is saying, and that woman, and that one, for totally unrelated reasons. So it was satisfying, at least, to hear him admit that, yeah, he hated women. We talked for 2.5 grueling hours. They flew by, but every second hurt. He was shockingly self-aware. He said he didn't troll anymore, that he'd really changed. He told me that period of time when he was trolling me for being loud and fat was a low point for him. He hated his body. His girlfriend dumped him. He spent every day in front of a computer at an unfulfilling job. A passionless life, he called it. For some reason, he found it easy to take that out on women online. I asked why. What made women easy targets? In retrospect, I wish I'd been even more plain. Why was it so satisfying to hurt us? Why didn't he automatically see us as human beings? For all his self-reflection, that's the one thing he never managed to articulate, how anger at one woman translated into hatred of women in general. Why, when men hate themselves, it's women who take the beatings. He did explain how he changed. He started taking care of his health, he found a new girlfriend, and he went back to school to become a teacher. He told me, in all seriousness, that, as a volunteer at a school, he'd just get so many hugs now. Seeing how their feelings get hurt by their peers, he said, on purpose or not, it derails them for the rest of the day. They'll have their head on their desk and refuse to talk. As I'm watching this happen, I can't help but think about the feelings that I hurt. He was so sorry, he said. Finally, I brought up my dad. How did you even find out that my dad died? How did you... I trailed off as my voice broke. He saved me the trouble of finishing the question. I went to my computer, I Googled you, found out you had a father who had passed. I found out that you had siblings. I forget if it was 3 total. I have 2 siblings. So, did you read his obituary? I believe I did, he said. I knew he was a musician. Yeah, I wrote that. My voice started to crack. The rapport I'd felt started to harden. I wrote his obituary. He hesitated at the edge in my voice. I created a fake Gmail account using your father's name, created a fake Twitter account using his name. The biography was something to the effect of, my name is... I'm sorry, I forget the name, the first name. His name was Paul West. I wrote, my name is Paul West. I've got 3 kids. 2 of them are great, and 1 of them is... He hesitated again. An idiot. Yeah, you said, embarrassed father of an idiot. Okay. Other 2 kids are fine, though. He exhaled. Oh, that's much more worse. And you got a picture of him, I said. I did get a picture of him. Do you remember anything about him? I was crying at this point. Did you get a sense of him as a human being? I read the obit, and I knew he was a dad that loved his kids. How did that make you feel? I wasn't going to be cruel, but I wasn't going to let him off easy either. Not good, he said. I mean, I felt horrible almost immediately afterwards. You tweeted something along the lines of, good job today, society, or something along those lines. It just wouldn't, for the first time, it wouldn't leave my mind. Usually, I would put out all this internet hate, and oftentimes I would just forget about it. This one would not leave me. It would not leave me. I started thinking about you, because I know you had read it, and I'm thinking, how would she feel? And the next day I wrote you. Yeah, I whispered. I mean, have you lost anyone? Can you imagine? Can you imagine? I can. I don't know what else to say except that I'm sorry. He sounded defeated. I believed him. I didn't mean to forgive him, but I did. Well, you know, I said, I get abuse all day, every day. It's part of my job. And this was the meanest thing anyone's ever done to me. I mean, it was really fresh. He had just died. But you're also the only troll who's ever apologized. Not just to me. I've never heard of this happening before. I mean, I don't know anyone who's ever gotten an apology, and I mean, thank you. I'm glad that you have some solace. He seemed surprised and relieved that I hadn't been more cruel. But I was just tired. I didn't have much anger left. We exchanged a few pleasantries. I thanked him. He thanked me, and we hung up. It felt really easy, comfortable even, to talk to my troll. I liked him, and I didn't know what to do with that. It's frightening to discover that he's so normal. He has female coworkers who enjoy his company. He has a real human girlfriend who loves him. They have no idea that he used to go online and traumatize women for fun. How can both of those people share the same brain? Trolls live among us. I've gotten anonymous comments from people saying they met me at a movie theater and I was a bitch. Or they served me at a restaurant and my boobs aren't as big as they look in pictures. Or they sat next to me at a bar 5 years ago and here's a list of every single bite of food I consumed. People say it doesn't matter what happens on the internet, that it's not real life. But thanks to internet trolls, I'm perpetually reminded that the boundary between the civilized world and our worst selves is just an illusion. Trolls still waste my time and tax my mental health on a daily basis, but honestly, I don't wish them any pain. Their pain is what got us here in the first place. If what he said is true, that he just needed to find some meaning in his life, then what a heartbreaking diagnosis for all of the people who are still at it. I can't give purpose and fulfillment to millions of anonymous strangers, but I can remember not to lose sight of their humanity the way that they lost sight of mine. Humans can be reached. I have proof. This story isn't prescriptive. It doesn't mean that anyone is obliged to forgive people who abuse them, or even that I plan on being cordial and compassionate to every teenage boy who pipes up to call me a blue whale. Footnote, whale is the weakest insult ever, by the way. Oh, I have a giant brain and rule the sea with my majesty? What have you accomplished lately, Steve? But for me, it's changed the timbre of my online interactions. With, for instance, the guy who responded to my radio story by calling my dad a faggot. That guy does not have a good life. Since this conversation with my troll aired on This American Life, I've had to report 6 more Twitter accounts using my father's name and face. one that scolded me for writing about my abortion. "Why did you kill my grandchild?" it asked. It got easier every time. It's hard to feel hurt or frightened when you're flooded with pity. Abortion is normal, it's okay to be fat, and women don't have to be nice to you. Just 2 weeks after my This American Life segment aired, copies of a leaked memo by Twitter's then-CEO Dick Costolo began flooding into my inbox from breathless friends. An employee had posted my piece on an internal forum where it got the attention of Twitter higher-ups, Costolo himself ultimately responding with this blistering communique. "I'm frankly ashamed of how poorly we've dealt with this issue during my tenure as CEO," he wrote. "It's absurd. There's no excuse for it. I take full responsibility for not being more aggressive on this front." Then, "We're going to start kicking these people off right and left, and making sure that when they issue their ridiculous attacks, nobody hears them. Everybody on the leadership team knows this is vital." "We've sucked at it for years," Costolo went on. "We're going to fix it." I was floored. Like, literally on the floor, rolling around. Bloggers, activists, and academics had been throwing ourselves against Twitter's opaque interface for years, begging for help, compiling sheaves of data on online abuse, writing heartfelt personal essays and dry clinical analyses, and suddenly, in one stroke, we had their ear. There was a human being behind the bird, and he actually gave a shit. The jury's still out on the long-term efficacy of Twitter's fixes. It's notoriously difficult, if not impossible, to retroactively change a community once bad behavior has taken root. Once users know how to exploit a system, it's hard to evict them without rebuilding the system itself from scratch. Still, to know that Twitter is aware and that they're trying, to have the CEO publicly throw his hat in with the feminazis rather than the trolls, is a victory, and a sign that our culture is slowly heaving its bulk in the right direction. Decisive victories are rare in the culture wars, and the fact that I can count three in my relatively short career, three tangible cultural shifts to which I was lucky enough to contribute, is what keeps me in this job. There's Costolo and the trolls, of course. Then rape jokes. Comedians are more cautious now, whether they like it or not, while only the most credulous fool or contrarian liar would argue that comedy has no misogyny problem. Hello, I am fat. Chipped away at the notion that you can help fat people by mocking and shaming us. We talk about fatness differently now than we did 5 years ago. Fat people are no longer safe targets, and I hope I did my part. All of those changes are small, but they tell us something big. Our world isn't fixed the way those currently in charge would have you believe. It's malleable. When I was a little girl, I was obsessed with a video game developer named Roberta Williams. She made point-and-click adventure games, King's Quest, Space Quest, Quest for Glory, a largely extinct genre in which exploration, curiosity, and problem-solving took precedence over combat and reflexes. As a corny king or a dopey spaceman, you wandered through brilliant interactive landscapes, picking up random shit in the hope that it might help you rescue a pissed-off gnome from a swarm of bees, or break a talking collie out of dog prison so he'll reward you with the magic kerchief you need to blindfold the king of the dead. I wanted to be Roberta Williams. I wanted to build worlds. In 9th grade, I enrolled in a beginner's programming class at a community college near my house. I was the youngest one there, the only girl, and the only one with no previous knowledge of coding, which wasn't a prerequisite. The teacher ignored me and chattered away with the boys in jargon I couldn't follow. I sat through 2 classes in a humiliated, frustrated fog, and never went back. I drifted away from video games. They didn't want me. I forgot about Roberta and grew up. I think the most important thing I do in my professional life today is delivering public, impermeable no's and sticking to them. I say no to people who prioritize being cool over being good. I say no to misogynists who want to weaponize my body against me. I say no to men who feel entitled to my attention and reverence, who treat everything the light touches as a resource for them to burn. I say no to religious zealots who insist that I am less important than an embryo. I say no to my own instinct to stay quiet. Nah, no thanks. I'm good. Bye. Ew, don't talk to me. Fuck off. It's a way of kicking down the boundaries that society has set for women. Be compliant, be a caregiver, be quiet. And erecting my own. I will do this, I will not do that. You believe in my subjugation, I don't have to be nice to you. I am busy, my time is not a public commodity. You are boring, go away. That is world building. My little victories, trolls, rape jokes, fat people's humanity, are world building. Fighting for diverse voices is world building. Proclaiming the inherent value of fat people is world building. Believing rape victims is world building. Refusing to cave to abortion stigma is world building. Voting is world building. So is kindness, compassion, listening, making space, saying yes, saying no. We're all building our world right now in real time. Let's build it better. Acknowledgements. First, to the Wests and the Oluos, I am so lucky. To my mom, Ingrid, for teaching me that there's a right way and a wrong way, for taking care of me, and for always following through. To my dad, Paul, for modeling kindness and ebullience, blazing creativity and unconditional love. I miss you. I wish you could have read my book. To my agent and friend, Gary Morris, who is just the best, for being so patient and encouraging while I figured out what the fuck a book is. To the whole team at Hachette, especially Mauro DePreta, it is so fucking cool that you hitched your wagon to this fat feminist abortion manifesto. Your confidence in me means everything. And I'm sorry I said fart so many times, even after you asked me to pump the brakes on that. To Paul Constant, Raffle Kroll Zaidi, Guy Branham, Corianton Hale, and Amelia Bono, for the guidance and reassurance. To every member of the Secret Book Writing Accountability and Crying Group, you are my medicine. To Charlotte and John McVane for the solitude and whoopie pies. To Hedgebrook for reaching out to me with such supernaturally perfect timing that I almost believe in God now and or wiretapping. To Megan Hatcher Mays for being a better version of me. You ate the 13th biscuit. To Annie Wagner and Jessica Cohen for my big breaks. To Ira Glass and Hannah Jaffe Walt. To every fat person who's ever sent me an email. To my Stranger family, my GHS family, and my Oxy family. To Tamora Pierce audiobooks, and every flavor of runts except banana. Thank you. And to my husband, Ahamefale J. Oluo, you are the best thinker and funniest joke writer and most brilliant artist in the whole world. But you're an even better partner. I love you. I love